This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among the most intelligent creatures that inhabit the Earth, dolphins are highly social, possess advanced communication skills, and are beloved by children and adults. Huge crowds flock to see dolphins at places like SeaWorld and more than 300 marine parks and aquariums the world over. But life in captivity doing tricks for applauding humans is a far cry from what dolphins experience in the wild. So what happens when captive dolphins are returned to the ocean? Our guest says it is a complicated and expensive process that is not as easy as just setting them free. Tim Zimmerman has written extensively about the captive dolphin and killer whale industry and is author of National Geographic's June feature story, Born to be Wild. Tim, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Glad to be here.
So an estimated just under 3,000 captive dolphins worldwide, same DNA, same anatomy as those in the wild. How are they different in their response to the environment?
Well, it's an interesting thing when you think about it. Their life in a marine park is so completely different than their lives in the wild that it changes them or it changes their orientation. So first thing is, in the wild, they move an awful lot. They're diving most of the day. They spend about 80% of their time deep underwater, foraging and socializing. In a marine park pool, even if it's a large pool or what seems like a large pool to a human being, it's very small for a dolphin, and they lose fitness because they're not moving around a lot. The other thing is they get very used to being fed frozen dead fish as opposed to having to hunt it themselves, and they're fed on a schedule. So that's completely different than in the wild, where they might not eat for a couple of days, and then they might come upon a large school of fish and eat a lot, and all their hunting skills atrophy, basically. And so does their interest in the idea that live fish are prey.
Hmm.
And the last thing, which is the most subtle thing, but also probably the most important thing, is that in the wild, everything is happening under the surface of the ocean for them. That's where they're foraging. That's where the other dolphins are. And in a marine park, everything of interest, trainers, the food, the audiences, the music, everything is happening above the water. And so a marine park dolphin, after a few years, starts to be oriented almost entirely towards the world above the surface of the water and spends maybe about 80% of his time or her time at the surface. And you have to kind of reorient a dolphin back towards the undersea world if they're going to be successful back in the wild.
So given that reorientation, what is the process of reintegrating dolphins back into the wild?
In the early years when people thought about this or even tried it, they thought, well, you could just dump a dolphin back in the ocean and its DNA and its genetics will, you know, remind it what it needs to do to survive. And that turned out to not be true. And some of the history of the early dolphin releases had very mixed results, with dolphins sometimes starting to starve and need to be recaptured. So these days, it's a transition that starts with moving from a marine park pool back to a sea pen to get back into the ocean, to hear the ocean sounds. And then the dolphin needs to be made fit again. And at the same time, to try to teach dolphins, or at least get them to feed on live fish again, and to reorient themselves away from human beings and human company.
How often has this been done?
There have been a number of dolphins that have been caught for research and held for very brief periods of time and then put back in the ocean. And they don't really stay in captivity long enough to kind of make this transition that we discussed earlier. But so what I did was I looked at the number of dolphins who had been in captivity and doing shows and had been trained to entertain humans for 2 years or more. And of that group, only fewer than three dozen have ever been either inadvertently or on purpose put back into the ocean. What was interesting about the dolphin releases, the two releases that I wrote about, was that they tracked and tagged both sets of dolphins so that they could confirm that they were back in the wild and that they were succeeding in the wild and learning how to hunt and not losing weight and socializing correctly with other dolphins.
And these two pair of dolphins, Tom and Misha, this is in Turkey. They were released into the Aegean Sea. And then a number of dolphins in process in South Korea. I'm going to let you say their names.
There were three in South Korea that were released in 2013, and they were Jeddol, Sampal, and Chunsam. And actually, there's two more that are in South Korea that are right now, as we speak, in a sea pen that were part of the same group that was being released. And their names are Taisan and Baksoon. And they will, if all goes well, be released back into the waters off South Korea in late June.
Are the plans for making that transition for the dolphin, is that individual? I mean, are there some dolphins that are best suited for this and others that don't?
Yes. I mean, what was very interesting about Tom and Misha, for example, is, particularly compared to the Korean dolphins, is Tom and Misha had a very rough existence in captivity. They were in two Turkish parks. One, I hesitate to even call a park. I went and visited the site. It's basically a cracked concrete swimming pool that was built in a little mountain town. Tourists would be bussed in to pay $50 to hang onto their dorsal fins and get towed around the pool. It had very bad filtration, so the pool was really disgusting, and partly the business went out of business because I think tourists would arrive and say, well, I'm not getting in that water. But the dolphins were very sick, and they had a very bad experience in captivity. So if they could succeed with those two dolphins, you could make the case they could succeed with most dolphins. The Korean dolphins then were an example of what could happen or how fast it could happen if you had dolphins that were in relatively good shape and relatively good health. And that transition in Korea happened much faster than the transition in Turkey. Ironically, it ended up costing almost as much money for obscure reasons, but it did show the range of dolphins that could be released.
Now, Tom and Misha, the transition was about 6 to 8 months long at a cost of $500,000. Who's behind this strategy and funding it?
A UK charity called Born Free stepped in. The Tom and Misha story is very interesting because really the fact that they became available to release into the wild was down to the fact that there were a number of local citizens in this small Turkish town who were outraged by the idea that someone was building a dolphin pool and was going to have these dolphins there. And they started a grassroots campaign, and they basically drove the facility into bankruptcy. And then they got a hold of Born Free, and Born Free was very keen to try to prove that you could take captive dolphins and release them back into the wild. Mm-hmm. And so they were willing to spend the money to do it because they thought that this was a very important precedent to be set as people start to debate captivity more.
Speaking with Tim Zimmerman about the tricky and costly process of returning captive dolphins to the wild. It's the feature story in the June issue of National Geographic. Well, let's talk about that debate about the benefits of having wild dolphins in captivity. What are the pros and cons?
Well, the captivity industry has long argued that having dolphins and killer whales, especially in captivity, teaches us a lot about them and encourages a child or even an adult who is thrilled by what they're seeing in a show pool to connect with a dolphin or a killer whale and presumably then support efforts in the wild to preserve and to promote and protect the species. And there's a lot of research that the captivity industry has done where they survey people leaving parks and ask them what they thought they learned. And people would naturally say, well, I think I learned about killer whales or dolphins, and yes, I find them fascinating, and yes, I support them. But what they never really survey is what they actually learn. The evidence is much, much more mixed on that. So the counter side of the argument is really that this is a profit-making industry, and it's about human entertainment, and it's not really about connecting people to wildlife. And the other part of the anti-captive argument is somewhat intuitive, which is just that killer whales and dolphins are very intelligent, free-ranging animals. And so I think the more people learn about their intelligence and how they live their natural lives, the more questions they start to raise about whether captivity and being in circus-style shows is really suitable or ethical for that kind of animal.
You do give a couple of examples in the article of dolphins being returned into the wild successfully. Any instances of the process failing?
Well, the most famous process or the famous example of the process failing, although people argue both sides of this, is Keiko, who was the star of the Disney movie Free Willy. He was a killer whale that was being housed alone in a marine park in Mexico City and became very popularized through the film. But then people, if they dug a little bit, they realized that he was in this terrible, terrible marine park and had skin infections and was likely not to live very long. And so a big effort was made to basically purchase Keiko and to take him into the Oregon Coast Aquarium, where he was brought back to health, and they started to work on his fitness. And then they flew him to Iceland, and they put him in a sea pen off Iceland, which is where he was originally caught. And they would take him out of the sea pen into the ocean on what they called walks. They would take a boat, and he would follow along the boat. And they would try to find wild whales to see if he would interact with them and ideally join with them. And he actually had a couple of bad experiences with the wild killer whales, which turned out to be very clan-oriented. And so eventually Keiko was released, and he, even though he never really connected with a wild killer whale group, and they never really found his family, which turns out to be the real key for killer whales, and he swam to Norway, where he started to swim up to people and fishermen begging for fish. And he was then cared for and fed for about another year, and then he died, unfortunately, of pneumonia.
Well, of course, in the Hollywood movie, Willie escapes, jumps over the jetty, and swims away to freedom.
That's right. And so that was the big irony, is that Keiko was going nowhere at the time. The interesting thing is dolphins and killer whales, even though they're the same species, killer whales are the largest species of dolphins, their social structures are quite different. Dolphins appear to be much more socially flexible. And so Tom and Misha, for instance, there was very little known about what their background was, where they were caught, whether they were part of a group or not. And it was possible to release them into the Aegean. And Tom actually spent time with other dolphins, as did Misha. But killer whales, people believe now, you have to find their native pod. You have to find their family group, because killer whales don't survive well on their own, and they're not flexible enough to join up with other groups, or it doesn't seem like they are. And so there's a lot more, I think, that would go into trying to release a captive killer whale than there is into trying to release a captive dolphin, and a lot more work has to be done.
Tim Zimmerman, thank you for speaking with us.
That was my pleasure.
Tim Zimmerman, he's author of the National Geographic June feature story called Born to be Wild. He's also associate producer and co-writer of the documentary called Blackfish, which is about the captive animal practices at SeaWorld. You can find photos and links to more information on the National Geographic's three-part series on dolphins. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.